This is the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, supported in part by the Daily Progress at dailyprogress.com. Catch up on what's happening in Central Virginia at dailyprogress.com. In addition to selecting representatives to Congress in this fall's election, Virginians will also decide whether to amend the state constitution to define marriage as being between one man and one woman. But the Commonwealth Coalition says the amendment may do much more than that and may change the way in which all contracts are treated under state law. The coalition is made up of groups across Virginia opposed to the amendment, including Equality Virginia, a gay rights organization. The executive director of Equality Virginia, Diana Mason, spoke to a group called Left of Center to discuss why she thinks Virginians should vote no in November. Left of Center is a group of progressive 20 and 30-somethings in Charlottesville. We bring you her comments now, as introduced by a member of Left of Center.
Tonight we are pleased and fortunate to have Diana Mason here, who is the Executive Director of Equality Virginia, and she is serving as the Field Director for the Commonwealth Coalition, the statewide campaign to defeat the so-called marriage amendment. That's on the ballot on November 7th. And prior to joining Equality Virginia, Diana Mason, she was the first full-time staffer at Equality Virginia beginning in 2003. Prior to that, she spent 3 years at the Human Rights Campaign in Washington, D.C., the nation's largest gay rights organization. The previous 6 years she spent at the nonprofit Fund for Public Interest Research Group, running grassroots environmental campaigns in California, New Mexico, and Arizona. She's a 1993 graduate of the University of Southern California. She's also a member of the 2003 Political Leaders class at the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership. And she was appointed to the Virginia Human Rights Council by former Governor Mark Warner. So let's give a warm round of applause.
Thank you for the introduction, Jenny. My name is Diana Mason. I'm the director of Equality Virginia. How many of you have heard of Equality Virginia before? Excellent. We are the state's gay rights advocacy organization. We're based in Richmond. We have about 15,000 members around the state and a board of directors of about 25 people around the state as well. We were founded in 1989, and it was about 3 years ago that we changed the name and to Equality Virginia from Virginians for Justice and kind of got reorganized and active, and that's when I joined. They stole me away from the Human Rights Campaign up in Washington, D.C. This year, Equality Virginia was a founding partner of the Commonwealth Coalition, which is the campaign effort to defeat the marriage amendment that's on the ballot this fall. I'm going to talk a lot about that tonight. How many of you have heard that there's an amendment on the ballot this fall? Okay. How many of you know that it defines marriage as between a man and a woman? How many of you know that it denies legal relationship recognition to all unmarried people, whether you're gay or straight? Okay, good. That's pretty good. Better than average, anyway. Let me ask, on the table you should have some of these cards. I'm going to ask that you take a look at the back side, or one of the sides, I guess, the one that actually has the full text of the amendment on it. Let's read it together, and I know this is kind of an elementary school exercise, but it'll sort of make my point. You'll see that in a second. Question number one, it's going to be question number one on the ballot. Shall Article 1 of the Constitution of Virginia be amended to state that only a union between one man and one woman may be a marriage valid in or recognized by this Commonwealth and its political subdivisions? Okay, that's the marriage part. That's the gay marriage amendment part of the amendment. Then it goes on to say that this Commonwealth and its political subdivisions shall not create or recognize a legal status for relationships of unmarried individuals that intends to approximate the design, qualities, significance, or effects of marriage. Nor shall this Commonwealth or its political subdivisions create or recognize another union, partnership, or other legal status to which is assigned the rights, benefits, obligations, qualities, or effects of marriage. Can anybody tell me what that means? What does that mean in layman's terms?
I have no idea.
Whatever a judge says it means, exactly right. I heard Jenny say, I have no idea.
I'd like to know what that means for, example, power of attorney.
Could it affect power of attorneys?
Power of attorney could affect second parent adoptions.
Could it affect adoption, second parent adoptions? What else might it mean?
Healthcare benefits
could be at risk.
Real estate.
Possibly buying a house or real estate? Child custody, what else? Insurance benefits. You guys are all right, and we really, honestly, we don't know what this thing means. The federal government has identified over 1,300 rights, benefits, and obligations of marriage in a report that was actually commissioned by the Republican Congress that come automatically with a marriage certificate in this country. Unfortunately, neither this nor anywhere else in the Constitution nor anywhere else in the Virginia Code of Law does it list out what the rights, responsibilities, and effects of marriage would be affected if this thing were to pass. Does it mean all 1,300 are affected and vulnerable, like your right to visit your partner in the hospital as next of kin? Or does it affect things like being able to make custody decisions upon your death for your children that you've raised together, but your surviving partner may not be the biological parent? Or does it mean that small businesses in this state may be denied the right to offer domestic partner benefits to their employees? Possibly. And it does leave it up to a judge to decide those questions. Because it's not clear. This is one of the most ambiguously written pieces of legislation and of any of the amendments we've seen so far in the country. We do know one thing, however, that this would ban civil rights, civil unions, and domestic partnership agreements or arrangements in this state. So we can't go the way of Vermont and have a civil union ratified by our state law. We also fear, and this is one of the biggest problems that we face with this amendment, and I think that could most significantly hurt people, is that in Ohio that passed an amendment in 2004, they found that, unfortunately, defense attorneys were using the constitutional amendment there to get domestic violence charges thrown out for their clients. Because if it's an unmarried abuser, and the state doesn't recognize that relationship, then it's not domestic violence, it's something else. And unfortunately, Virginia's domestic violence laws are constructed similarly to Ohio's, and Virginia's proposed amendment is written similarly to Ohio's. We actually know that there are defense attorneys who've told the Virginia Sexual Domestic Violence Action Alliance, a group that supports stronger laws to protect victims and prosecute abusers, we already know they've been told that defense attorneys will use the amendment to try to get their clients off if the amendment were to pass. And that could directly leave people at risk for losing their life or facing continued abuse and violence in their life. And that's something that's already happening in Ohio. In Michigan, that also passed an amendment in 2004. A very popular health benefits program for state workers and their partners, their unmarried partners, was thrown out the minute that their amendment passed. And that was a benefit that the state workers there had worked very hard to secure over many years of lobbying their legislature. It's working its way through the courts, but again, it leaves it up to a judge to decide that what that final question is. So what minimally we believe that this amendment would easily prevent all universities, public institutions, even school teachers, even state workers from being able to offer domestic partner benefits to their employees if they choose to do so, which if any of you are involved with the university here, that is something that's been high on the list of the gay faculty and staff caucus meeting that meets pretty regularly here. They want to have domestic partner benefits because most of the other top-notch research institutions in the country have them. So it prevents them from recruiting and retaining the best staff to come to Virginia for that. So, what do we do about this? Does anybody have any questions? I don't want to just stand up here and talk about the amendment or some of the consequences.
Can you explain if someone can't file for domestic violence charges, if you can't use that as a way to file against your abuser, what are the other opportunities? Say this does pass, and
right.
Women who are being, or men who are being abused domestically, what's their option then?
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
It'll affect the protective order because it defines people as living together as being in the same household or having a child in common or defines as being in the same household. So it'll more affect the protective orders than the criminal charges, but there's another subsequent criminal charge if you violate the protective order. If you don't have the underlying protective order, that's one less thing you have.
So there's a greater consequence for someone who's been convicted?
Yeah. There, no, it's okay. There's, you can prosecute under a flat old assault charge, right? But unfortunately, that doesn't kick in. An assault charge doesn't kick in the additional protections offered to victims of domestic violence, such as protective orders, which allows you to live in your home and keep your partner away even though they're on the deed, or allows you the use of that common car, or allows you custody of your children while that partner has to stay away from you. It also allows you and offers you free and safe assistance to get to a shelter by the police department. It also offers additional support for the abuser by being able to get into counseling programs and things like that. All of those things would not be available to victims if they could only file under a plain old assault charge. Plus, if you get convicted, I think, of three times of domestic violence, you have a higher penalty than a plain old assault charge would provide. So it leaves people really, really vulnerable. And Virginia does not have restraining orders. The only protective order you can get is a protective order if you're defined as a sort of living in a domestic situation. And 60% of those are offered to unmarried people in the state right now. It's quite significant. Yeah?
How does this relate to H.R. 171? This wording sounds very familiar, but not quite the same.
H.B. 171? H.B. 170-101? One, or H.B. 751? Okay, the one that passed a couple years ago?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The wording is very similar, yeah.
How many of you guys remember the Marriage Affirmation Act in 2004? H.B. 751. That was also introduced and written by Bob Marshall, who is one of the key sponsors of this bill. That bill went into law in 2004, and it prevented civil unions and domestic partnerships or any other legal arrangements between people of the same sex only. Now, we believe that this amendment was actually written to constitutionalize the worst parts of HB 751 by extending it to everyone, and then also preventing any type of legal relationship status for any unmarried people, whether they're gay or straight. So it's even worse than HB 751 to some degree, because it goes much further than that. We do know that this version of the amendment was also constructed to try to repeal the health care bill that we passed last year that allows all businesses in the state to offer domestic partner benefits if they choose to do so. Prior to our bill passing in 2005, it was actually illegal and impossible for small companies to offer domestic partner benefits in Virginia. We were the only state that had such a restriction. So we got that out of the way, but we believe that this was intended to get right back at that and repeal the law that we passed last year and go back to where we were 2 years ago.
So if this is rejected, then HB 751 would still be in place?
Yes. If this is rejected, HB 751 would still be in place. Unfortunately, fortunately, as you know, it is much easier to repeal a bad statute than a constitutional amendment. You cannot find a constitutional amendment unconstitutional. So we have to then go either repeal the amendment through the same process, you know, through the legislature and then for another popular vote, or we'd have to file on a federal level on federal constitutional charges.
You made a distinction between small businesses and large corporations offering domestic benefits. Why are small businesses affected and not larger multi-state corporations?
Right. Large companies like Capital One, so forth, they often have... they're self-insured. They have so much money, and they have people all over the country, so they're self-insured. They don't have to go through the Virginia Bureau of Insurance to get their insurance policies approved. Unfortunately, small businesses aren't able to do that. If you try, prior to our law passing, if you tried to get domestic partner benefits and buy a larger package for your employees, you got a nice little letter back from the health provider saying, sorry, according to state law, we cannot cover these extra individuals. So it was really... just an unfortunate hassle that was leaving a lot of companies out of being able to offer the protections to their employees that they wanted to do and treating all their employees equally that they wanted to do. Yeah?
What is the support for this amendment right now? I
mean,
are there any polls that have been...
Right. What's the support? Are there any polls? Some of you may have seen some polling that came out a couple weeks ago in the paper that found that 56% of voters in Virginia supported the amendment if it were to come up today. What those stories didn't tell you is they only asked the first question. We only asked the first question last year, and we found that 56% of voters in Virginia would have voted for the amendment. We only asked the first sentence. What we did, though, we spent some money earlier this year doing some research, and we actually read the whole thing to voters. And once we read all three sentences of the amendment to voters, the support drops to 45% saying yes, and 40% saying no, and that's a statistical dead heat. So it's pretty simple. I mean, the solution to this problem is not to go out and convince people that they should support gay marriage. It's just to ask them to read the damn thing. So one of our big messages that you'll see over and over, and why there's three copies of the amendment on your table, and over and over and over again, is to just get people to read the whole thing. Because what they do is they read it and they go, I don't know what that means. And the first question you should ask anybody, if you don't know what something means, you shouldn't put it into the Constitution. So that is certainly one of our big pushes over these next several weeks, is to do that. Yep.
I got in a little late.
Sure.
I forgot to mention this, but I wonder how this conflicts, as it seems to me, with contract law.
That's a really good question. And I think that's one of the challenges we're facing. You're going to see actually a little later this week a memo that's been written by a law firm up in D.C. sort of deconstructing the amendment and trying to see what laws and settled rights would be affected by this. And that's one of those things. What's ironic is that the only tools that gain, because we can't get married in Virginia, we haven't been able to get married in Virginia for 30 years. We passed the first anti-gay marriage law in Virginia in the 1970s, and we've done it a couple times since then. I guess they have to come back to it every couple years to get their good old gay bashing chits in. But the thing that we found out, I just totally blanked.
Contract law.
Is that the more that gay and lesbian couples construct legal arrangements to protect themselves and their families, which are the only tools we have available to protect ourselves, to put together a really good estate plan, to make talk to our families about what we want to do with our children if one of us dies, to make sure we have a medical power of attorney, to get domestic partner health benefits through our work. The more that we construct these arrangements and the more money we spend, and it does cost money to get these together, the more it looks like in a marriage and the more that those contracts would be vulnerable to challenge. Because the more it approximates the design of marriage, the more those things would be unenforceable in a court of law, which is a really unfortunate and ironic twist on this. Yeah?
Does it not, though, also update, no matter my sexual orientation, mm-hmm. I can't make a contract of any sort with another woman?
That I think, yeah.
The implication of the law, and that seems to be a huge problem.
Again, I think that was probably a little bit more clear with HB 751, but that is something that does leave open. It sort of opens up a can of worms, and I think the impact of this will be mostly like those inter-family struggles about family members coming in and demanding a piece of the estate or arguing over child custody if you break up or any of those types of things. I think those are the types of situations that we're going to see have to work themselves out in court. And unfortunately, I don't have the answers because nobody knows. And that's, again, why we certainly shouldn't rush to put that into the Constitution until those answers are clarified. There was actually a version of this that went around the General Assembly last year that didn't make it. There was actually three versions of the marriage amendment introduced last year. That would have specifically left some language in there saying this would not affect things like contract rights. It's called a savings clause. General Assembly chose to take that out, which a court is supposed to assume means they wanted to affect contract rights. So, again, we're going to have to see if this passes, we're going to have to see how the courts start to come down on this. This week you may see some information from the Attorney General's office saying, oh yeah, it's not going to do the things you're worried about. It's not going to affect health benefits. It's not going to affect adoption, or you'll be able to visit your partner in the hospital. They're saying that because they know it's our strongest argument. And they're saying that because they're trying to make it seem softer than it really is. But in places like Ohio and in Michigan and other places, those same folks who said that beforehand have come back and filed lawsuits to get the broadest interpretation of the law possible, including filing a friend of the court brief in a domestic violence case in Ohio where they said, yeah, the domestic violence statute should not apply to this case because they weren't married. And so that's who we're dealing with. They'll say what they can to get this thing passed, and then they'll flip-flop as soon as it's passed.
Chris Graham in the Augusta Free Press, he came out with an article today, and he interviewed the guy from the Family Foundation, Chris, obviously
Chris Freund.
Support of this marriage amendment. And Chris Graham made a point that the one simple rule of politics is to keep it simple.
Mm-hmm.
And so as you go door to door, I mean, yes, you want people to read this, but then how do you make it as simple as possible so that when we go out and educate mm-hmm. our friends to let them know that everyone needs to vote no?
Mm-hmm. If you take a look at this piece here, the first piece, the sort of half sheet, that actually has a lot of information on there. It was our best guess at what we thought would be influential to the average voter before we got all of our research back. This piece is much more affected by that, by our research. And we do know that we have three main messages that came out of our research this year. First one is read the whole thing. Second one is don't write discrimination into the Constitution. And the third one is unintended consequences. And the more, again, I think the more that we can ask people, read it. If you don't understand it, don't vote for it. Because there's a lot of people in this state who have come a long way in embracing gay rights and understanding our issues. And there's a lot of people who have yet to even start taking those steps forward. But in the middle, there's a lot of people who, although may not support gay marriage, may be nervous about the fact that this may affect all unmarried couples in the state, even unmarried heterosexual couples who want to be able to set up and protect their families just like anybody else. So that's a really important thing that we can pass along. And I think my experience going door to door is that resonates with people, along with the denying civil unions and domestic partnerships, too. Our polling last year, just so you how far Virginia's come, I know you guys are kind of in a little bubble here. I have a board member who lives here who calls Charlottesville a slice of Massachusetts in the middle of Virginia. But the rest of the state, I think there's an assumption that Virginians are very intolerant and aren't fair-minded and are homophobic to the extreme. And all of our polling has shown that that's not the case. In fact, Virginia is right in the middle of the whole country. Our polling actually is almost exactly identical to what Wisconsin's showing right now on their amendment campaign. So we're right smack dab along with everybody else. And one of the surprising things that came out of our polling last year is that 59% of Virginians support civil unions. Who would have thought 5 or 10 years ago that that could even be possible? So that's very, very exciting for us. And we know we're going to win this fight. The goal is, do we have enough time? Do we have enough voters? Do we have enough volunteers? Do we have enough money to get the 1 million votes we need to win on November 7th? That's our trick. Yeah.
Judge Wilkinson,
yes,
host, made the argument that I'll try to paraphrase, and you can correct me if I'm wrong. But
I've only seen a summary of it. I haven't read the whole thing yet.
Okay, well, I read his argument as being extremely critical of the amendment, saying it was stupid. But then, in a roundabout way, blaming liberal judges through decisions like Roe versus Wade and the Massachusetts Supreme Court decision, he sort of blamed liberals for constitutionalizing privacy issues in the first place. So the way I read his argument was, liberals have created this problem by making these constitutional issues, which was the wrong thing to do in the first place, and now conservatives are coming back and making the problem even worse. The question I have is, it from a standpoint of legal theory, it seems like a pretty good analysis of what happened, and what's the liberal rebuttal to his argument?
To the blaming the liberals thing?
To the fact that, the fact that liberals made privacy a constitutional issue.
Right.
By not being willing to wait for the political system to resolve these issues, but saying that they were found in the Constitution.
Well, I'll let Holly Hatcher answer that. She's chomping at the bit here. Go ahead.
I mean, I like my birth. I mean, that's the case right there. I mean, unmarried women could have birth control. I mean, there's lots of lawyers in the room. I'll let them answer.
Right.
Broader about that. I mean, the answer is why did this become a liberal cause? It became a liberal cause because it was necessary.
Right.
I mean, Brown versus Board of Education came along because it was necessary. Roe v. Wade came along because it was necessary. Conservatives have been minding their own damn business, leading people to live their lives the way they wanted to live them. it would not have been necessary for the judges to step in ahead of the legislature to say, wait a minute, we have constitutional prohibitions against these sorts of things. It's hence, you know, you've got Plessy versus Ferguson in the late 19th century, and then you've got Ford versus Brown versus Board of Education saying, wait a minute, this is necessary. You have to step up. I mean, that would be my counterargument.
I think the thing to remember is that the promise of the Bill of Rights of the U.S. Constitution has yet to be fully realized. And we have come back to those arguments and those questions over and over and over again. And this is just the next battle in that frontier of protecting marriage equality for all people in the country. Is something that Equality Virginia believes in very strongly, and I believe in very strongly. And this is just the next fight in that effort. I completely agree with the gentleman's analysis down there that, you know, if the as you put it, if the government hadn't put barriers in the way and stayed out of the way and government kept out of the lives of American citizens, then we wouldn't have had to do that.
I have a question. So, the authors of this bill are calling it the Marriage Amendment Act. What are we calling it? Because that's
right.
Pretty, you know, that's not a real favorable name. How about like anti-family?
Yeah. There's been a lot of talk, and I think down in South Carolina they're calling it the Anti-Family Amendment or something like that. We chose not to do that. We'll call it the Marshall-Newman Amendment, or we'll call it Ballot Question 1, or the so-called Marriage Amendment, because unfortunately the average voter, we found, doesn't even know this is happening this fall. And if they know it's happening vaguely, they usually relate to it through what they've seen in the press that has called it the Gay Marriage Amendment. So if we wanted to try to reframe that debate, we'd have to not only educate people about a new definition of the amendment itself and remarket, you know, the whole title, and then try to convince them to go out and vote no. So we're just going for the second part. We just got to convince them to go out and vote no. We don't have the time, unfortunately, to try to reframe the entire issue. No matter what we do, we're going to see the press will still continue to call it the Gay Marriage Amendment. And in fact, Mr. Freund at the Family Foundation, and his boss, Victoria Cobb, who's the director of the Family Foundation, she actually called up one of the papers in Roanoke, I think it was the Roanoke Times, and said, stop calling it the Gay Marriage Amendment. That's part of the liberal media conspiracy. And why is that? Because if people think are going in for the Gay Marriage Amendment, hell, I'm going to vote no on that. Ugh, gay marriage, no. So we continue. It's true. It's true. So it's a wash. I think what we're going to struggle with mostly is to make sure our people, our voters that we've identified this year and will continue to identify, know what is the right way to vote. I mean, we have to go through this whole elaborate thing with our volunteers to make sure they know a no vote is against the amendment and somebody who's with us. And a yes vote is somebody who's for the amendment and against us. It's kind of almost like a double negative thing, and it's really kind of a challenge to get people, even our volunteers, to sort of know what the right thing is. I mean, there was a blog posted about one of our phone banking nights, one of our volunteers, and she said she spent all this time talking about the amendment. The woman at the end said, oh, yeah, I don't believe that's the right thing to do. I think that gay people, you know, shouldn't get special rights, so I'm going to vote against it. So, I mean, that'll be a constant struggle for us. That's a bigger struggle for us, I think, than, you know, what to call it.
Becky? What's the plan? How's the campaign going on the ground?
Thank you. Nice segue. I didn't plant her, really. Okay. We have just about 2 months to go. The election's on November 7th. We have to get 1 million votes in order to win. And we need each person who cares about this issue to get as involved as you possibly can. I'm in charge of the field team, which means I help oversee the face-to-face, door-to-door, one-on-one conversations with folks around the state as we build our voter file. Any of you who work on campaigns know all about that. Going out and finding our voters and then making sure we turn them out on election day. So there's some things that you can do. You can write it. Have we passed out this take action
Not
sheet
yet?
Okay, let's do that. Let's pass out the action sheet. The first thing you can do is to get 10 people to pledge to vote no on the amendment. If everybody gets 10 people and they go get 10 people and they go get 10 people, with just 10 degrees of separation, we'll have 1 million votes in our bank. You can download one of our pledge forms on our website at votenova.org and get folks to fill it out and then send it back in. Another thing you can do is you can invite a speaker to come from the campaign and talk to your church, talk to a class, talk to another organization that you may be involved in, come and talk to a group of friends at your house for a social event, whatever. There's a form on our website you can type right into to request a speaker, and I or somebody else from the campaign will be able to come and talk to you and your guests about the issue. We've been doing a lot of outreach in churches and those types of things, so we encourage you to do that. The third thing you can do is make a contribution. We need to raise a hell of a lot of money these last 2 months in order to do the type of advertising that we want to do. And a gift of $10, $20, $50, $500 and up will really help add up and really go to work for the campaign. Plus, if somebody just makes a simple contribution of $1, they're much more likely to remember to go vote and to vote with us on Election Day. So encourage everybody to get involved financially as well. We have a lot of activities going on locally that you can plug into as a volunteer if you're not busy working on the WEED or web campaigns. A couple are on here on this sheet. We have tabling at Fridays after 5 every Friday. And we also are every Saturday at City Market. And there's some information here about who to RSVP to if you're interested in that. All you have to do is just sort of staff a table and pass out a clipboard, pass around a clipboard, asking people to pledge to vote no, telling them a 30-second spiel about the amendment and why they should vote no on November 7th. The other thing you can do is write a letter to the editor of the papers here. The more that we're active and involved in the public debate, and that's the letters to the editor pages of most papers, the more we'll be able to move the dialogue forward. If we're absent from these pages, the dialogue stops. So we really, and especially if you're not gay, to be a straight ally of our community and to speak up is very, very important to us. One other thing I haven't mentioned yet is on September 21st, which is a Thursday night, we're having a night of 100 house parties. The goal of these events isn't so much to raise a lot of money, although that would be good. We're going to encourage people to make donations, but we're trying to get the buzz going in the communities by having lots of small events, inviting your friends to come over, talking about the amendment. We're preparing a little 10-minute DVD that you can show your guests as a little bit of educational tool about the amendment. And so sign up. You can sign up online for that. You can send me an email about that, and we can get you plugged in. It's more of a friendraiser as much as we're expecting them to be fundraisers. So encourage everybody to think about hosting one or attending one if you're invited.
All right, one more question.
Yep.
So I'm at a dinner party with my parents and all their conservative married friends.
Leave quickly.
Because yeah. You have concern for their fellow Virginians. How does this affect them, and how can I talk to them?
I think the thing to point out is that this is one of the most broadly written and ambiguously written measures that we've seen in the entire country, and that it is going to open up a Pandora's box of litigation for this state. And as the gentleman already said, it's so sweeping that it could affect settled law and settled rights. And if we don't know what this is actually going to do, the least thing we can do is to not amend this version and not put something so ill-written and ill-conceived into our Constitution. Another good one is on the front page of this, and this appeals to a lot of Republicans. We have a lot of Republican members of the coalition, is that this allows government to intrude into our private lives, which if you're a true Republican and a true conservative, should mean something to you. So, yeah.
I was just going to add that conservatives also talk all the time about activist judges and how, you know, activist judges take the law into their own hands. And this amendment really plays right into that because it puts the law in the hand of, quote, activist judges to decide what is legal, what is a valid contract, and what isn't.
Right. And just to put on the record, Virginia doesn't have activist judges. If anything, they're activists in the other way because they're appointed by our General Assembly and can be removed if they don't toe the line. So, and they have been removed. So that is a fallacy for at least Virginia's courts.
All right.
I think that's it.
Thank you so much.
Okay, thanks.
You've been listening to Diana Mason of the group Equality Virginia, speaking out against the constitutional amendment to define marriage as between one man and one woman. Mason made her comments before the group Left of Center at their September meeting held at Star Hill. This recording is a public service of the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at cvillepodcast.com. I'm Sean Tubbs. Thanks for listening.